Well, thanks, Craig. Hi, everybody. If you're all new to Zoom, the rules are a little different in the room. As long as you have your mute on, you can make as much noise as you want in your private setting. So if you want to, like, you know, boil tea and get up and get your tea, it's totally cool. My name is Peter Panagor. As Craig said, I live in Maine on the coast. And in 1981, I died while I was ice climbing. And Alberta, Canada, in Banff Provincial Park when I was 21 years old. It changed my entire direction of my life. I had other plans. My family had other plans for me. But by the time I came back, I was a new person in an old body, born again, you could say. I'll cut to the end a little bit before I tell you the story, so I'll fill in some of the blanks that Craig was alluding to. Instead of going to graduate school in architecture and joining the family firm, I went to Yale Divinity School, and I studied mysticism while I got my Master's of Divinity. The Dean of Students allowed me an independent study for 3 years, and so I created a course of study for myself with her guidance, at the end of which, those 3 years, I had intended to go on for my doctorate. But she talked me into seeking ordination in the United Church of Christ. And so I did. Now, meanwhile, I told nobody about my near-death experience. Nobody knew. I kept it a secret because it was kooky. Who could I talk to? That I was at divinity school in order to figure out what had happened to me. No, I had no context for it. I felt like I was living inside my body as a stranger in a strange land, as an alien, like an avatar, like in the Matrix or in the movie Avatar. I live inside my body. That's a physical daily experience for me. I never forget that. It never goes away. I can interrupt it if I'm doing some sort of sporty flow thing, if I'm skiing or running or biking or something, or if I can interrupt it, but I can't stop it. So I got ordained and I became an associate minister in Connecticut. And then I took two churches off the coast of Maine on an island. They were a mile apart and they hated each other for 100 years on an island the size of Manhattan with 3,000 people. And my job was to teach them to love each other and join together, which is what happened. And now they're a happy bunch, many years later, decades even. I then got recruited to a resort town where there was a swanky church. And it was in that church where there was a huge embezzlement that preceded my arrival, hundreds of thousands of dollars stolen by the treasurer and who was also the financial secretary, who created great discord in the church. And there was a lot of secrecy and pain and suffering, and I was in the middle of it, a target. They tried to defrock me and ruin me personally and professionally, a small group that was actively protecting the treasurer. When this was all over, after 9 years of suffering, so the embezzlement was like 15 years, when it was all done and over with and she was prosecuted, I climbed into the pulpit one morning and the deacons came up to me, sent an emissary and said, "We're sorry that we treated you the way that we did. And you must have had a lot of faith to put up with us." And I decided not to lie to them anymore. I've been telling them the absolute truth about everything because I can't help but living connected to the light. And it's not my light. I don't own it. It's God. And I am this tiny in comparison. Everybody is, but everybody's beloved. And so I told them that morning the truth that I, from the moment I came back, I told them the whole story. And by that point in my life, I'd only told my wife and two friends. And so I told the whole congregation that morning that is the story and how I know God is real and I know where I'm from and I know where I'm going. And it gives me a lot of after effects. And the after effect that was most powerful in my time in the church in Boothbay Harbor, Maine, was courage. And the courage I had came from knowing you can't kill me. You can ruin me, but you can't kill me. I can't be destroyed here. You can hurt me, you can, but you can't. I work for God. Only God is real to me. And so that's an after effect. There are other after effects as well. Loving everyone, being empathetic, lots of other things too. So then I got recruited into television. I did 15 years. People waiting room. Go, come on in, people. Oh, it's my job. Oh, I'm the host now. Thank you, Craig. All right. I will, if you continue to alert me to that, I'm happy to continue to do that. And for those of you who are just joining us now, I'm the host of the meeting because that makes me big on your screen. Is that true? You can shake your heads. If I'm small on your screen, you can go to the upper corner and find the way to use it'll say gallery view or
Speaker
speaker
view.
view, speaker view. So I ended up in television for 15 years doing these daily devotions, telling inspirational stories to 100,000 people a day on two NBC stations in Maine. And then I finished that about 2 years ago after, and now I'm still in my studio. This is where I work and where I live. Not, I don't actually live in the studio. And I continue to work for God, because from the moment I came back, and now we're going to swing down around to the beginning of the story like a like an epic, is that when I was 21 years old, I went ice climbing in Alberta, and I made a mistake. I was there. I'll tell you why I was there. I was there because I was an exchange student from the University of Massachusetts to Montana State University because I was running away from my family. Because my family was in pain and suffering, and this is integral to the story, or I would not tell it to you. My family was suffering because my sister had run away, vanished from my mother's point of view, and my mom had a long breakdown, and my dad was very angry, and there were more complications than I can describe. But I split to Montana to
Get away from.
So then I didn't want to go back to Boston in March for spring break. And I'd been a mountaineer, backpacker, Boy Scout, National Ski Patrols, working at Bridger Bowl in Bozeman on the ski patrol as a volunteer that year. And I'd done a lot of mountaineering, never gone ice climbing, but a lot of winter camping. So I found a partner to go spend spring break in the wilderness of Western Canada in the Rocky Mountains. And we went snow caving for a week. In the far back country, skiing into the base of Mount Assiniboine with, geez, I think my pack weighed 70 pounds, when we left, food and all everything we needed, and then we skied out. And Tim was a my partner. Tim was a registered lead ice climber and rock climber. I'd climbed rock. I'd never climbed ice, but I was a mountain goat by nature, and so. We went to this climb, and Tim had all the gear, but I didn't have all the gear, so I borrowed or bought, used all the gear that I could, and I came up with everything that I needed: crampons and boots and a helmet and gloves and everything I needed. But I couldn't come up with two axes, so I came up with one axe and a hammer. And what that meant was essentially is that with the axe you can rest, you can put it in the ice, and there's a hole of 2/3 of the way up the axe. With a piece of webbing that you a loop, you put your hand through the loop and can slide a bead down and hang and rest, so you can actually relax when you're climbing. But with the hammer, the same strap falls out of the bottom, and you can put the hammer in, but you can't ever rest. So because I couldn't rest every other swing, I burned out my muscles and slowed the climb down. And so by the time we got to the top of the 500-foot climb, it was sunset and the temperature dropped about 30 degrees, and it was March. And hypothermia set in within minutes because we weren't dressed for the 30 more degrees minus, and we were wet from the climb, and we had eaten all our food and drunk all our water. And all the other teams that had been on the same face with us that day were walking out to the parking lot on this, and there was like 10 feet of snow on the ground. And they were walking packed snow. And the sun set and the temperature dropped, and we knew we were in serious trouble, serious trouble. So we discussed spending the night there, snuggled up against the face. This is a 10,000 or 12,000 foot mountain we're on, and we're only 500 feet up. But we could have been at the tip top of the mountain for all that mattered. We were so stuck. But we decided that if we snuggled up against the mountain, you know, canoodled, we would die because neither of us had enough heat in our bodies to sustain the other one, let alone ourselves. And so we realized pretty rapidly that our situation was dire and that we had to fight to live because we knew we would die if we stayed. And we thought we might die if we went. So we took the odds, and Tim pulled up the rope. This, meanwhile, hypothermia set in, and now I've got the shakes. I'm shaking like rapidly. So is Tim. Our jaws are clattering like a cartoon. And Tim pulled up the rope, about 300 feet of rope, and it became a big knot because he didn't lay the line right because we were both scared. And now we're stuck. Now I had to untangle this long rope in the dark at night. All we had was starlight. And so I had to take off my gloves, which meant I began to get frostbite. And by the time I got the rope undone, an hour later, I don't know, I wasn't paying attention to the time. I was well advanced into the early stages of hypothermia, and so was Tim. We were still shaking. It turns out that shivers keep you warm, or it's like your body's trying to keep you warm because it's moving everything, but it exhausts you too because it sucks up all your energy. So you're consuming all your energy while your body's trying to stay warm. And we had very little energy left as it was. So we roped each other off and in the dark traversed across the ledge, the cliff, to the next rappel and got to it. And this rappel was a little tree sticking out of the rock growing up. I don't know, something like that. And you're supposed to take a piece of this same kind of nylon webbing. Someone has their mic on. I think it might be Karen. If you kill your mic, Karen, then it'd be great. Thanks. So you tie this piece of webbing together and it becomes this big loop and you put it around the tree and then you take the rope and you stick it through so that when you're at the bottom of the rappel, you can pull the rope through without friction. So it doesn't freeze to the tree, but we were stupid, frozen. Our brains were becoming not rational. And we decided that we wanted to save the nylon cord. And there's more people coming in. We wanted to save the nylon cord. Welcome, everyone. Sorry that I'm playing host too, and I forgot to look. So when we got to the bottom of the rappel, we pulled the rope and the rope was frozen to the tree because we didn't use the webbing because we didn't want to waste the webbing because it cost money. So we wrapped the rope around the tree instead of running it through the loop. And when we got to the bottom, we couldn't get the rope free. So we're a third of the way down, but now the rope is stuck again. And so we tried to yank on the rope with all our weight. We couldn't get it free. So Tim decided to reascend up the rope, free climbing, using this thin nylon cord tied in these certain hitches. So I'm wrapping it around the rope. There's two ropes here, and he ties these hitches around the rope, and it's got this long loop. And when you grab hold of these hitches, if the rope is taut, that was weird. What the heck happened just then? Someone hit share screen. Somebody's sharing their screen. You are viewing Bonnie's screen.
Boone Newsom.
So if you go to the top of your screen, there you go. That's cool. So, and that happens. It's all right. You know, I'm very relaxed in Zoom rooms because everybody's trying to figure it out. So it's totally, don't worry about it. So we're on the second rappel and we're knee deep in snow and the rope is stuck and we can't get it free. And Tim ties these two hitches with these big loops so that he puts one foot in a loop and one foot in the other loop and takes his hands on these two hitches. And I've taken the rope and I've wrapped it around my waist and I've rolled into the snow, making this whole thing taut as I could make it. And Tim begins to ascend up the rope with no protection. So he's sliding up the rope, lifting one foot, lifting the other foot, and repeating. And he gets up like 20 feet and the rope jerks free and he falls down. I roll out of the way, lands in the snow. Nobody's hurt. But now we've lost our coordination. Now we can't really move well. So hypothermia continues to advance. And our feet are frozen like blocks of ice. And we're petrified. And I don't think I mention that often enough when I tell this story. I was petrified. I was driving. Tim and I were both, we weren't panicking. We were both really level-headed. But we were both driving ourselves because we knew what the odds were. And the longer the night went on, the colder we got, the worse the odds became. And so at this point, we're beginning to lose our ability to move our lips and our jaws because things are freezing. And we decide not to talk. So we really couldn't, but we decide also only to talk when it was most important, essential speech only, because speaking drained our energy. So we had so little energy left that when we talked, we knew that we could both feel our meters going down. So around this time, a car drove down the highway. And I don't know if you know anything about that part of the world. You're all Utah. You're out in Utah, right? So Jasper's up here and Banff is down here. We're kind of in the middle between them. And it's the middle of nowhere. And one car drove by and we're waving and jumping up and down. And they never see us, of course, because who's going to look up there? But about an hour later, as we're beginning to leave to the next rappel, a truck pulled into the parking lot and turned and flashed its lights at us. And the night before, we had spent up in Jasper buying some food. Pardon me, the evening before, we had spent in Jasper buying some food and drove down after dark and talked the warden into letting us sleep in the cabin with him. If we cooked him dinner and cleaned up after. So we cooked him dinner and he let us spend the night. And in the morning, we signed into the log. So that night, like everybody else, signs into the log so they know you're going into the wilderness. So he met us, and he came looking for us. And so he's across in the parking lot flashing his lights, and we're jumping up and down and waving our arms. And he flashes the lights. We know he sees us. We feel, well, not saved, but heartened. And we're off to the next rappel. And now we're in the dark because the moon has risen up, but the shadow falls where we're headed. So we go into this shadowy area, and in the rock is an iron pin with an iron ring through which we put the rope. And Tim descends down first and goes down 150 feet, 200 feet. I don't remember what the distance was, and turns the corner. And now he's on a ledge 4 feet wide, 6 feet long, and two iron pins and two rings with carabiners and straps with carabiners. So there's side-by-side protection in this particular spot. It's permanent. And we come around the corner and Tim locks in. I come around behind him and I lock in. And the warden sees us. We wave. He flashes his lights. He pulls out and he leaves. So I take the rope and I tied the bitter end, which is what it's called, to my harness. And I took the other bitter end and I tossed it off around the corner to pull the rope through. But it's on the very first pull, what I figure is that the rope had laid inside of some kind of V and it jammed. It just snugged right up. First pull, didn't even pull it an inch. Zip, totally snugged in. It's stuck now. And the length of the rope from the stuck to the amount of tail on my knot was, I had this much tail on my knot, which meant I had no slack at all. And so Tim's off to this side and I can't get the rope free. And so we talk about, does he try to help me pull the rope, but he can't really reach it he can get to here on me because he's harnessed in. So he just can't reach it. And so we talk about me untying it and trying to get it to him and we could drop the rope and then we'd really be screwed. And so we decide I have to pull the rope. So my job is to try to get this rope free. And I begin to try to get the rope free. Hour after hour after hour, darker after darker after darker, interior, more and more fear. hypothermia continues to advance until it gets to the point where I get hot, which is I'm not really hot. I think I'm hot, but my body is responding to the trying to save the core by expending the things you don't need. You don't need your arms, you need your heart. And so I unzip my coat, even though I knew better, ski patrol, pulling people off the mountain with hypothermia all winter. I had frostbite and everything else. But my rational mind had gone. My feet were like, you know, those ice blocks you buy in the summertime at the convenience store. They were like, that's how they felt. I couldn't even bend them. And I realized that I was going to die and there was nothing I could do about it. And so I started looking out at the beauty of the, because the moon was up and I could see the beauty of the mountains and the distance and the starlight and this sort of peace came on me. Because it was a piece of resignation, not a piece of the flow of God, but it was peaceful, but it was a peaceful kind of thing where I decided I can't fight anymore. I give up. And I began to fall asleep. And when I would fall asleep, my consciousness would go dark and I'd collapse to the ground and I'd hit the rock and I'd wake up from, hitting the rock, and I climb back up again and stand back up and try to pull on the rope again. And this happened a whole bunch of times, but then I stood up, and this time, instead of my wide view, my view became tunneled. I had tunnel vision, physiological hypothermic thing. And at the very end, that's the last thing that happens. And so this tunnel began to fade to black pretty rapidly. And I was looking around, looking through, and the tunnel got smaller and smaller and smaller, and psh, total darkness. Total darkness, but I have consciousness. It's like I fell asleep, but I'm not asleep. I'm wide awake. And I'm wide awake inside this darkness, thinking to myself, how come I didn't feel myself fall? Why am I still, am I standing? Where am I? What is this? I was completely confused. And then I sort of looked out. And when I looked out, I saw this infinite expanse of darkness that was, well, it was infinite in every direction, in front of me and beside me. And way far, far in the distance, there came like a pinprick of light, way distant, further than the end of the beginning of the universe. And it communicated to me with an intelligence as it rushed toward me at impossible speed, faster than light, and it enlarged and compacted at the same time, and it's communicated without language directly to me. It said, I'm taking you. And I thought, no, you're not taking me. I don't even know what this is, but I'm not going anywhere. And so I put up all my willpower that I'd strengthened through the night. Tim and I drove ourselves on willpower to survive. And that drive, I've never used it to that level ever since. I have this space now inside myself for driving myself forward. And I've never touched the bottom of it since that night. And so I put all of that willpower up against this entity, which was rushing toward me, communicating with me. And it just said, I'm taking you. And it plucked me right out. Like, just plucked me right out. And I was fully resistant up until the moment I got plucked. And as soon as I'm plucked out, I'm enwrapped and I'm being communicated to comfort, contentment, remembrance. And I get rushed up this tunnel, up. This is all metaphor. There's no up, there's no down, there's no sideways, there's no distance. And I get rushed up this tunnel, and this tunnel is wide and narrow at the same time. And the next thing I know, I'm sort of popped out into this infinite illuminated darkness, is what I describe it as. I can see in every direction at once, like I was a single eye. I have questions here. People are popping in questions. I will ask Peter to let you in. If you have any questions, please put them in the chat box. Okay. So I get popped out into this infinite illuminated darkness. and I can see in every direction, and I am like a, I'm a, like an orb of consciousness. I am an, and I just, I realized today as I was talking to somebody that I stopped saying it the way that I'm going to say it right now, because it was difficult for people to hear this, but there was, this was the place of no thing. Now, if you think about that, no thing, no matter, no quarks, no molecules, no air, no nothing. It's essentially to say that God is nothing. No thingness. And I stopped saying it that way because people would say, well, God's something. And I would say, not like any something you can name or we can know here, except for we do get glimpses of it. Lots of people get mystical glimpses of the presence of God. Lots of people have mystical experiences. They just don't name them that yet. I can talk about mystical experiences if we have time. Yours. And so I'm in this orb. I'm this orb and I'm 10,000 times bigger. And it's like, this is who I am. Now I remember. How did I not know? How did I forget? And I could see in every direction at once. And my brain and my eyes and my hands and my ears and my everything about me is one thing. There's no separation between thinking and seeing, or hearing and seeing, or being and understanding. It's all I am a unified thingless orb of consciousness. And then like a doorway opened, I tell it sequentially, but there's no sequence. This is timelessness. And when I say timelessness, I mean all time in every dimension and no time at all at the same time. Past and future, present, of all, everywhere, all at once. And so there's no future and there's no past. There's only now. But it contains all future and all past. And all possibilities of all of those things. And this doorway opened up like a humongous portal. And it was covered with this shimmering flow that was translucent and transparent at the same time. And I could see a tunnel arcing off way far into the distance. And I touched this with my beingness, and because it was shimmery, and when I touched it, it infilled me. It called my name. It told me who I was. It knew me and loved me. And it was all there is and all there was and all there will be. And it flowed into me like a living, like a rush of living water that expanded to my entire size. And I heard my name called, and it wasn't Peter. It was the essence of the creation of my soul. It was that which called me into being when I was first named, when I was first breathed. And at the same time that I heard my name and knew myself for the first time, I knew myself for the first time since I was Peter, because I knew myself because I'd always understood that I was a creature, but it was also new to me. Hard to explain. And I could see the long tail of my soul. My soul was, I could see my long self all the way back to the moment of my creation as a, like a photon of light separated from the unity of all being. And in my long everlasting soul, there were these thin slivers emanating out that were small, and there were many of them, and they felt to me like Peter, but not like a Peter, but like another existence somewhere and sometime, someplace. But I couldn't see what they were. And if I did see, I don't remember. I can't see it now. That's one of the side effects of near-death experience. Whatever you see on the other side, you only come back with a little tiny bit. And that little tiny bit is unspeakable. And so you're stuck with knowing this great thing and not being able to communicate it, even to yourself, because there's no concepts that we can use to grasp it either. And so, not fully anyway. So meanwhile, while this was all going on, I was also being told I was creature and that this was creator, and this voice was speaking inside me and was all around me. It was the entire infinity, and yet it was very personalized and very present and individuated and speaking inside of me as I heard it outside of me, no language. And it was called my name, and it told me, I am creator, you are creature, I made you, everything about you is mine, I made you. And it wasn't vindictive, it was just love. And then I went through my life review. And my life review was that I got to suffer all the pain that I gave away my entire life to everybody. In sequence, the pain I intended to give to people and the pain I didn't intend to give to people. And my experience of their pain was 10,000 times greater than the pain that I thought that I gave them. As big as I was as an orb, each bit of pain that I gave away was that size. And it turned out that I didn't actually give it to them. I actually gave it to me. And I suffered all of the pain I gave away times 10,000, intended pain and unintended pain, from their point of view, juxtaposed to all of my reasons and rationalizations for causing their pain, whatever my reasons were. And my reasons were nothing in comparison to their pain. It was my reasons were this big, and their pain was the size of the galaxy. And meanwhile, I'm judging myself as guilty. And the voice is speaking inside me, saying, I love you. I made you. You're my created creature, my beloved. I know you. I've always known all of this about you. I've always known all of this about you. Nothing is hidden from me. And I love you as you are. I love you. I forgive you. I love you. And I also saw simultaneously, as I looked as I could see the infinite size of love that dwarfed me into this teeny tiny nothingness. I could see the teeny tiny nothingness of every human sin, just like mine, in comparison to the immensity of the divine, were nothing in front of it. And that there was no, I didn't see any differentiation between one person's sin and another person's sin, or even between my sins. Because, not because they weren't that way on earth, but because in heaven, in comparison to infinity, everything is nothing. And the voice said, I love you, I forgive you, I know you, I forgive you. And then I was forgiven. And I was infilled with this combination of healing, wholeness, peace, love, beauty, joy, awe, understanding, knowledge, adoration, bliss, paradise, and all the truth. And all those things were not separate. They were all one thing. They were all unified in love. And they expanded inside me to infill me to the very edges of my of the consciousness orb that I was. And I was expanded so far with it that a little more of it would have felt like it would have destroyed me, obliterated me. But I was in bliss. And adoration and love. I was in love, literally in an ocean of love with the ocean of love inside me. And I said, am I dead? No language, communication, telepathic. Am I dead? And the voice said, yes, you're dead. I said, well, I can't die now. The voice said, why not? It's time for you to come home. I love you. Come on in. I said, well, my parents lost my daughter, my sister. And my mom's broken and my dad's angry and I can't, yeah, if I die, that's going to destroy them. And so in an instant, I was swept out of heaven. I still had all the love inside me, but I wasn't in the ocean anymore. I was like brought to the edge of the ocean and shown Earth in the universe and the real world, but it was like looking at a hologram because I could see every single person on Earth all at once. And every single person at Earth all at once, whatever they were doing right then. It was like watching a movie with 7 billion people in it. And I could see every one of them individually. So I could see them all, but I could also see each one of them. I can't explain to you how that is. And everything was covered by everything, the whole Earth, and every human being was covered by a veil. And I could see everything else on Earth too. It wasn't just human beings I could see. I could see everything on Earth, but it was the human beings that were the focus. They were the illuminated part. Everything else was dimmed down. And God said to me, in the way that I love you now know I have always loved you. And was, is, and will be, my love is eternal for you. You are my beloved creature. I have always loved you with this love that, and this is the hardest part of telling this story, is that the amount of love is like all of the matter and all of the universe put into one spot. That's how much love there is, only it's not enough to use that measurement. That measurement is too small. The love was, it's eternal. I can't even explain it to you, but I knew the truth of it. I knew the truth that love is all there is. All there is. And I was beloved, and I knew that every single human being, I could see that every single human being was beloved. So in the same way that I felt beloved and the special favorite child, I could see that everyone was beloved and everyone was the special favorite child. And I know that that can't happen to humanity, but that happens there. Everybody is beloved, made beloved. And the voice said, in the way that I love you now, I've always loved you, but also said, because of my love, all is well, has been well, and will be well. Then you know this. You experience that all has been, is, and will be well because you've been healed now. You're infilled with healing. All your suffering is gone. You see who you truly are. You're not a flesh and bone bag living on a planet. This is the true you, and that is true for everyone down there. And now since you know that's going to be true for everybody, and it's going to be true for your parents, so you can stay. Because they're going to find this out when they die. And you know now that the length of your life is the length of the wink of an eye. That's my example. That's how long my living life felt when I was there, like that fast. 21 years, that fast. And the same will be true for your parents, God said to me. And I should say this, God had no gender. God was not a person. God was a love. I don't even... None of the concepts we have are adequate, or maybe all of them are altogether, maybe. But even that's not true. That's not enough either. So the voice said, meanwhile, I could see the pain on my parents' faces. I could see my parents' faces in particular, the pain that they had then and the pain that they would have over their entire life if I were not there, and knowing that in the end they would be well. So you can come and stay, Peter. And I said, I'm in a theater company and I'm leaving on this big tour, national tour in a week. It was as part of the university. And been in rehearsal, and I made a promise to the director that I wouldn't get hurt and ruin the tour for everybody. Because he was pretty upset that I was going off into the wilderness like I was. And God didn't answer my question when I said, you know, my statement, I got another commitment. And then God kept asking me to come home, but I realized I had to go. I mean, I wasn't being invited, but I wasn't being forced. And so I said, I haven't gone to the door yet. Do I have to go? And God said, I want you to come, but no, you don't have to. I said, well, if I go back to help my parents, can I come back here to this oneness of being, to this heaven? And God said, yes. And I said, well, then I choose to live my life. And God said, you won't live your life, and sent me back. And on the way back, I was presented with 10 million entry points back into my life. They were like a circle, and in the center of the circle was an intensity of white light, but that white light spread over a large area and then radiated out in sort of dimness, and there were all these like 10 million entry points through the dimmerness and the brighterness. And it was like this, and I just picked one. I remember thinking, well, I don't want to totally be in the light. I think I'd rather be a little bohemian. I kind of, because I was a hippie at the time. And I'm like, I don't think I want to give all that up. And so I chose this place to entry that was not in the center of the light, but it was not in the darkness. But it was closer to the light than not. And the next thing I knew, I was being crushed down into a much smaller package and shoved inside my body, which was full of pain. And that's the first sensation I had was pain. And it lasted a long time. And I didn't know what it was. I couldn't comprehend it. I had just been in bliss. I had been in painlessness. And now I didn't comprehend what was going on. And because my soul was in my body and my brain wasn't online, I couldn't even use my brain to figure it out. And eventually my brain kind of started up again. And I was like being jostled and I'm wondering, where am I? What is this thing? I don't understand. I couldn't, but I wasn't thinking in language quite yet. I was hearing this noise, and eventually I kind of surfaced up, and Tim had me by the shoulder and he was yanking me up. And remember, he couldn't really reach me because of the length of the cords. He's just trying to pull me up as close as he could get. And he pulls me up, and I stand up, and I don't know. I must have looked at him like I had no idea who he was. And because I didn't, or who I was for that matter at all. And he finally, I understood language was coming back to me. And he's screaming at me. That's what the noise I'd been hearing. You were dead. If you died, I was going to die. I had no idea what he was talking about. And he got me to pull the rope, and I pulled the rope, and it came free in the first pull. And we descended, and now my brain's back online. I'm kind of back in my body again, but I'm totally an alien inside this body. But I know that I still have all my memories. I still know I'm in a terrible situation, but I know that I'm like not this person. Now I'm in this thing, and I'm like, oh, this thing's in a bad situation. I got to help this thing out. And so we descend down, and we get our tent, and we treat ourselves for hypothermia. Because I was trained, and we warm ourselves up slowly, and eventually we get in the car and we heat up the car, and we, by, I don't know, an hour after sunup, something like that, we were warm again. It took us about maybe 3 hours. I don't even know what time it was. The sun was pretty high, but there were no teams there yet. It was probably a couple hours after sunup by when the warden came back looking for us, seeing whether he had to collect the bodies. I could keep going with the story, but I could stop for a moment here and see if there's anything people want to talk about. I don't even know how long I've been talking, probably too long. Any comments or questions, anybody? You can drop them in the chat, or you can, yeah, there's someone showing up there. I put my glasses on so I can see this. Is this meeting being recorded to be added to the IONS website in the future for listening? Does Peter have a podcast, video, radio show we can follow him on? I don't have a podcast. My radio and TV shows ended, but you can follow me on Facebook. I'm active on YouTube. I have a lot of material up on YouTube, and I run meditation groups there, and I started if you go to my website, let's put it this way. If you go to website, peterpanagor.love, you can find links to my YouTube channel and the places where I'm active. I've decided to not have a podcast right now. So on Sunday mornings, I'm doing this thing called, I started it about 3 weeks ago, Not a Church, because I am not a religious person, but I have a background in, you know, I was a preacher for all those years. And I think that the language of religion is useful for spirituality, because from the moment I came back and I picked up the Bible again, I saw it in completely different eyes. And then I went to divinity school. How did I know to go to divinity school? I I was headed to the monastery. I wanted to be, I went to a private Catholic high school. I learned meditation when my senior year in 77 from the school of the Centering Prayer School. I don't know if you know about Centering Prayer, Thomas Keating, Basil Pemington. They had studied with Sasaki Roshi and Maharishi Mahayogi, but they were Trappists and they developed Centering Prayer. And I was in the position to learn it. So I began to meditate. And so I had this association with the monastery and I started, and when I came back from dying, I was like, I got to go talk to these monks. And so I ended up going on a retreat there and decided to become a novitiate and began that conversation, but was a little chicken about it. And so decided to go to divinity school. So I applied to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, and I got into 2 out of 3 and I went to divinity Yale. But my intent was never to become a minister. My intent was to study mysticism and go back in the monastery. I was going to give myself time to think over the monastery, get a background in contemplation and mysticism as an intellectual exercise to create a concept to grasp the history of conceptualization of the unity of divine experience, which is loaded in Western Christian tradition. And because I was a Christian, raised Orthodox and Catholic, and afterwards I was really not a Christian. I was disguised as a Christian because I belong to God. Christianity takes belief. I don't believe. God is real to me. God is the only real that there is. And so I went to Div school to study mysticism, to create concepts inside my head so I could process what I needed to process and gain some understanding of where I had been and who I had become. And learn techniques for the practice of meditation and yoga and centering and prayer, which is what I did. So I went to divinity school as kind of a way not to go to the monastery. How could you resist that much love and come back to earth? Oh, because I knew the love was going to be there. How could I resist so much love and come back to earth? That love, I knew the love was going to be there. What I really didn't know was how awful it would be to be separated from it here. And I didn't understand that. And I was pretty PO'd about that for a long time. I was more like Job than I was like anybody else. I was like, you didn't tell me that I was going to be stuck back in this awful, two-dimensional, flat, ugly, uncomfortable, painful suffering. I was mad. I was angry for a long time. And that was part of my whole keeping the secret thing, because I was like, because the voice inside me was saying, you have to tell everybody. I'm like, A, you don't, I you didn't give me any words. What you're communicating to me is ineffable. So how am I supposed to do that? And B, you didn't tell me how awful it was going to be. And so I was pretty angry for a long time about it. But that didn't mean that I wasn't also experiencing the light all the time. I couldn't shut it off. So I knew it was going to be there. So that's why I was able to come back. I knew I can go back to it. I know I can go back to it. I was told I can go back to it. I expect to go back through my own purgatory again. I don't know that that's the case, but the fire of the divine love cleansed me of all the excess baggage that I didn't need or couldn't bring into heaven with me. I needed, in order to be infilled, I had to be emptied completely. And all the suffering I gave away was in my way. And so that was kind of burned off of me with love. That was my experience. I don't speak for anybody else. Do you receive God's guidance now? Yeah, I do. And it's not what you might think it is. It's not like God saying, turn left. No, turn left. No, it's more like the deeper I go in my prayer life, in my meditation and life, and I've been in pursuit of this now for 40 years of meditation. And it carves a channel inside you and you knock on the door. It's like Teilhard de Chardin talks about the divinization of the self. We have a job on this side. Our job is to reach back to heaven. And that involves mental focus in order to stop the ego from telling us stories about false stories about who we are. And when we can stop the ego from telling those stories, we gain access to the holy. And so I don't seek God's guidance like, what decision should I make? Because that's like this individual fragmented thing. It's like somebody pursuing joy, which is beautiful, or love, which is beautiful, or guidance, which is wonderful. But all these things are fragments of this one thing. And if you pursue the fragments, you get those things. You get the guidance, you get the love, but if you pursue the one thing, you get all those things. And it's like this radiance that pervades everything all the time. And so I live my life making my choices day to day, moment to moment, trying to keep the channel open so that as I make those choices, I stay closer to the light. So I'm not like, and I work hard, okay? I'm not navel gazing. That's only because I have a big nose and I can see it on camera. Navel gazing all the time. I'm working my tail off. I'm a worker. And so I create my future, but I also recognize that all of my futures, when I came into that point of entry back into my life, it was like a suspension bridge cable, a big one where individual strands are wrapped around, and you enter into one strand and you're in that strand, but it's this, all these choices that you had, except for that strand isn't individuated. It bisects and bisects and bisects with every single choice we make. And so it interplays with all these other strands. And all of those were potential futures for me. And so as I live my daily life, I have another after effect. And that other after effect is I live sort of dislocated in time. I know that's a weird thing to say. I have deja vus. Only my deja vus can last long periods of time where I see what's going to happen a moment before it's going to happen. I just see it. It's kind of like, you know, in Star Wars where how the Jedi work with their Jedi swords. They see it before it happens. I don't have that much time, okay? It's not like I have time to like see the sword coming toward me and get my sword up. It's more like I see it a moment before it happens. And I know that I'm supposed to be there. But I also know that I could have made other choices and I would have supposed to have been there too. So the guidance thing is, for me, is much more about not making the individual choices, which I know can be 10 million choices, but to choose instead to pursue the oneness of being so that every choice that I make has the best chance of being the better choice. Does that kind of make sense? People, nods, yes. We're running out of time. We're good. Because I'm good. If you guys are good, I'd like to hear anything more, but also interested in our own mystical or your own mystical. Yep. Who or what is God to you now? What is sin? So do you see God as an energy or entity? I'll grab the mystical stuff toward the end. If I get reminder, especially, okay, could you make sure? And I'll definitely talk about that because I want to talk about that. But that's a little bit different than what we're talking about. But I want to because I think it's important. Who or what is God to me now? God is reality. God is all there is. God is love. God is the light. God is the flow of peace inside me. God is the energy essence of my being. God is the light that I see in other people. It's the radiance around them. It's the light inside their eyes. It's the presence I feel when I walk up to someone who's radiant and I feel this energy coming through. But all of these here are filtered through the world. They're all filtered through our bodies and filtered through the molecular structure of everything around us. But deep inside me, like two-thirds of me has not come back ever. I'm still like two-thirds over there, which is what is mess me up in life, because I could never really fully be present here. I'm always somewhere out there looking in through this thing. So part of me is always connected to the eye wherein God sees me. The eye wherein I see God, God sees me, wrote Meister Eckhart, which is true for me. It's the same I, only it's not mine. I don't know how to explain that part of it. So God is love for me. If I have to sum it up in a word, and I do sum it up in a word, to talk about God, God is love. And not just one particular kind of love, but every kind of love there is on earth. The love you have for your dog, for your mother, for your cousin, for your friend, for your enemy. Every kind of love is the presence of the divine. And all of that, all of those are fragments, portions, tiny bits of the wholeness of the oneness of being. God is ineffable. I can use all sorts of words to talk about God, but not one of them comes close. Who or what is God to you now? What is sin? Sin is separation. Sin is causing pain. Sin is giving suffering. But sin is also separation. And so imagine the unity of the oneness of being. It's only perfection with a capital P. And once that fragments away to create the reality of our universe, it's less than perfection. And so already in its very existence, it's a fragment. It's all fragmented away. And so it's a separation. It's a separation from perfection that creates the imperfection that makes the universe. And so, you know, in Adam's fall, in Adam's sin, we all fall. In Adam's fall, we all, oh, what the heck is that saying? There's this old Christian saying, you know, it's Adam's fault. When he died, he left us original. When he sinned, we all got original sin, whatever that little saying is. You know, mythologically in Genesis, you could think of that as the whole creation of universe, of the universe, is based in limitedness, separation from the purity of the divine. And that's how we cause pain to each other. We think that we're separate from each other. That's our experience. That was my experience with all the people I caused pain to in my life. I gave them the pain because I didn't think that they were me. And now I know that they are me. And so every time I give pain away, and I do because I'm a human being, and I live here, and I, you know, and I still got my characteristics, and I still do the things that I do, and I don't want to hurt people, and I try not to hurt people, but I do. And I know that every time I do, I'm creating separation. I'm separating myself from them. So does that kind of make sense? Yeah, God is not an entity unless it's a capital E. If you want to put a capital E on that word entity, or the capital E on the word energy, then I'll go with it. Because every time we talk about God, it's all in metaphor. And the best that we can ever do. So for instance, if I say duct tape is good, okay, and then I say God is good, where's the comparative there? Because everything about language, all language is constructed on comparatives. That's how the whole thing works inside our heads. It's you. This is black, I can't think of a good example. Oh, the end of this. This is black also, but it's not quite the same black. So we compare them, and this one's charcoal, and this one's, you know, shiny, whatever. All language is based in comparatives, but you can't compare God. God is incomparable, inconceivable, ineffable, and so the only thing that metaphors. Is the only language that we have, and it's the language that Jesus spoke. That's why he was so freaking misunderstood. It's the language that all mystics speak. Jesus was speaking, he was like a code switcher. He spoke two languages at once. He spoke Aramaic, and he spoke metaphor. And people always think he's talking physical, but he's not. He's not talking physical when he was talking about God ever. So in order to bridge that gap, so in my books when I write, every time I talk about God, I give it a capital G. If I'm talking about goodness, and when I talk about goodness for something else, a little small G. That's the best I can say with that. Entity and energy, yes, but with a capital letters. Because none of them are perfectly accurate. The link to my best meditation video At YouTube, on my YouTube channel, I can't tell you what the link is. I could probably find that for you, but I have a YouTube channel, and one of my more popular videos is the meditation video, and I've got two or three of them there. But a book, Open Mind, Open Heart by Thomas Keating, Centering Prayer. Open mind, open heart. And meditation, I like to call it heartful meditation. That's kind of the language that I'm leaning towards these days. Not mindful meditation, but heartful meditation. Same thing, but your heart's oriented towards God. That's the difference. Because that doesn't happen in meditation necessarily. What is a deja vu? A deja vu is sort of like, oh, I've been here before. Oh, I remember meeting you before, but I never met you before. I remember this moment, but I never experienced this moment before. A deja vu is sort of a memory. Well, it's a memory of the future. That's kind of what a deja vu is. Where does Jesus Christ fit in? That's a really huge question, and I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah, so when I came back, I pick up the Bible because I went to Catholic school. So I read the Gospels one a year, freshman to senior year. So I was familiar with it. And so I pick up the Bible and I look at it, and I was a born-again Christian. Okay, I was a born-again, slain in the spirit, charismatic Catholic Christian when this happened. I was a backslider. Okay, I was a pot-smoking hippie. But I also, at the time, had been born again. And so I was familiar with Jesus. And when I picked up the Bible again, the first thing I realized is that nobody really understood him. He looked like a near-death experiencer to me. He talked like one. And I don't think he died for your sins the way they tell you that he did. I think that I got forgiven after I was dead. I didn't repent. I was forgiven. I repented in death, and I judged myself. I can't speak for anybody else, but that's what happened to me. And I think that Jesus came as like the light incarnated, like we're all incarnated. Okay, every one of us is incarnated, but incarnated in a concentration that people noticed. I mean, this guy was doing miracles, and that's why people followed him. And he had a radiance to him. But I don't think he ever came to die for our sins. I think he came to join the world of suffering and point to heaven and say, it ends, and love is the answer. And when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but through me, the operative words there for me is, I am, which is what God called God's self in the Hebrew scriptures. The I am, the I is. And Jesus was never really talking about himself. When he's at the cave at Lazarus' death, and you know, the crowd's there, and Mary and Martha, the Lazarus' sisters, are there, and everybody's crying and there's mourning, and he goes in front of the, and Lazarus has been in there 3 days, so he's, that's like serious raising the dead. But he prays, and he prays out loud to the Father, and he says, I'm praying out loud to you to raise Lazarus, so that they can hear me, because I know you always hear me, but so I'm saying this out loud for them. But in that sentence, he separates himself from the Father. He prays to God to make this happen. Jesus, the man, knows that he is not the, he knows the light is the holiness. He knows that. It's, and all he says, they say he's the light of the world. And what does he say? He says, no, you're the light of the world. You're the same as me. You'll do greater deeds than I do. He's always making himself less and always making God more. We're the ones who've deified Jesus. I don't think he ever intended it. I think that that was a mistake that became religion. And that's okay, because that helps a lot of people. It hurts a lot of people too, but it has helped a lot of people. I hope that's a little bit of an answer. Do I believe in reincarnation? Don't believe in it. Think it's real. Think I saw it. Pretty sure that I did. So But does everybody have to keep coming back? God, I don't want to come back again. There's only one way I would come back again, and I had that talk with God today. But mostly, no, I don't want to ever come back again. Why would I do that? I've already come back twice, and both times it's been, I mean, I've fulfilled my duty so far, but, ugh, yuck. What do you think is the purpose of life, and why are we here? I think the purpose of life is love. I think it's like William James, one of my new favorite books about 3 years ago, Ulysses. Is that William James? Yes or no? Ulysses. Anyway, he says, love loves to love love. I think that's why we're here. I think we're love loving itself. We have experiences of the divine and the holy here. But I don't think we have a purpose like people say, and I think this may be true for a lot of people, but I don't know if it's true for me. People say this is like a school. We're here to learn. But when I was dead, this is like the stupid place for me. This is like the unlearning place for me. When I was dead, everything I needed to know, I knew. Boom. I wanted to know about physics because I like physics. Boom. I knew everything. Like, it wasn't just like all the physics that the humans know. It was like all the physics that is known, that creates it. Here's God's like, here's how it all works. And in an instant, I knew and understood. Do I know that now? No, not a bit. So why would I come here to learn when all knowledge is accessible to me when I'm dead? I don't know. All love is accessible to me when I was dead. So, but maybe that has to do with maybe there's soul levels, and I don't know the answer to that question, but maybe there are young souls and old souls. And maybe young souls have to learn here for a while. And the older you get, the more you learn there. That's, I can't explain that. I just know that the purpose here for me, as I experience it, is to love. Is to love as much as I possibly can love in the context of my life. And that love, when I died, I carried like three things with me. I carried some of Peter. I still had some self-identity because I was thinking of my parents. Even though I was in the unity of the oneness of being, which is this contradiction, but the whole thing is contradictory. I carried the suffering I gave away, the sin I gave. I brought my sins with me, and I brought all of the love that I gave away and all of the love that was given to me. So all the love I gave away, I got to keep. And all the love that was given to me, I got to keep. And that's true for every single person. So all the love I give to my sister, she gets to keep, and I get it back in equal measure. Only it's 10,000 times greater. So there was like twice as much love as there was sin, so to speak, metaphorically. And so to me, the whole thing is about the treasure of life, and the whole thing, the treasure of life is love. That's where I, so the purpose of life is to love. That's it for me. Because I'm an infinitesimal and I don't matter whatsoever. I saw myself in relationship to perfection and infinity. I am a nothing. And not only am I nothing in comparison to that, I'm a nothing in the universe. In the history of Earth, in the history, the geologic history of Earth, Peter Panagor is a zero. So is everybody else. Nobody really matters in the length of time. There's nothing left of us in a million years. Nothing left of us here. But if we're eternal beings, which we are, immortal beings, which we are, spiritual beings having a human experience, as Deschardins said reputedly, and, well, that's what matters. Not here. What matters here is the gathering of the treasure. So if we want to help humanity, we're in COVID-19. You know, this whole thing could fall apart. It's not, imagine the worst case scenario, not hard to do, right? What's going to bind us together? What's going to keep us in community? It's going to have to be love, because there ain't nothing else. So this is a practical application on a global scale. For the first time in the history of the world, we're all suffering the same anxiety. It is of biblical proportion. It's an apocalypse of biblical proportion because it really is the whole world this time. That whole mythology about Noah's ark and the flooding of the earth, it's not the whole world that got flooded, no matter what the scientists, these fake scientists are trying to prove with, you know, oh, there was a flood in this country and there was a flood in that country. Well yeah, there have been floods all over the world. All the plate tectonics have been shifting under the ocean and back up again for millions and millions of years. But this is the first time in the history of humanity where we've all suffered the same cataclysm and we're all at risk of the same collapse. And so what's going to keep us together through this? Zoom? Communication, love, kindness. I heard this local church bishop say on our public radio interview, he said, you know, charity is love, which is true. Charity is another form of love. And it's charitable to love your neighbor by not trying to kill him by breathing on him. It's charitable to love your neighbor by trying to protect all of humanity by not spreading the virus. I thought that was beautiful to me. That's practical love. Do you think the purpose? Do you feel like you found your soul? Oh, more like my soul found me. I am my soul. I found my soul found itself inside this body. Yeah, I guess. To answer your question, did I find my soul? Yeah, but it turned out that what I found was me, and what I thought was me wasn't. So it wasn't so much that I found my soul as that I remembered who I really was. So yeah, definitely to that. James Joyce, thank you very much. James Joyce, that's right. Ulysses, a great book. Took me 3 times trying to get through that one section before I finished it. Turned out to be my favorite novel. Hard as it was to read. Do you read anything by Brian Weiss? I've heard the name twice this week for the first time in my life. Coincidence? But no, I haven't yet. But somebody was talking to me about him just the other day. What about Christ's second coming? Yeah, he never left. He's here now. The light has always been here. That's the other thing. He says, "I leave you the Paraclete." He comes back and he's in the room and he breathes on the disciples and he says, "Here, I give you this gift." But I think it was always here. It's like, you know what Shakti is. You know that word Shakti? It's a deliverance in Hinduism. It's a technique that yogis use to pass the energy of life, the chi, the prana, the Holy Spirit, whatever language you want to use for it, into another person to give them a glimpse of the holy. I think Jesus was like given glimpses of the holy when he was walking around. That's what his radiance and his aura was all about, his halo. But I also think that in that scene, I don't remember which gospel it's in, but the disciples are gathered and they're all afraid they're going to get killed because they're on the run after his crucifixion, and he shows up in Galilee and he breathes on them. I think he gives them the gift of the Spirit, but I think the Spirit has always been here. I think the light has always been here. The whole thing is made of light. The whole universe existence is the light itself. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems that Christianity got wrong is that they don't see it's easy to postulate saying that he's going to come again when you can't see that he's already here. When you see that he's already here, then you don't have to worry about him coming again because it's already present now. Always, it's God's always here, and we're just blind to it. And that makes me a heretic, just saying that right out straight. I am definitely outside of fundamental literalist evangelical Christianity. But oddly enough, when I hang out with the Pentecostals, they got the Spirit going on in that group. Theologically, we are like poles apart. But I preach in Pentecostal churches, which surprises people because we're simpatico. They got the Spirit going on. And I know it. I see it in them. And they know it. They see it in me. So I'm good with anybody who's carrying it. Doesn't matter to me who they are, or what their slant is. But COVID is dividing us even more politically. Yeah, well, politics. You got to have government, or else you have chaos. I mean, that's where the law of Hammurabi came in. When, you know, the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, did you know that was like an upgrade? That was good law. They're like, everybody's like, oh yeah, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's a good thing. Because before that, if they took out your eye, they killed you. If they took out your eye, you killed everybody in their family. So there's like violence run wild. And the law of Hammurabi comes along and they say like, oh, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And then comes along Jesus a while later. He says, nah, let's not do that anymore. Let's not do that anymore. And politics is all about the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Only it's a up, only it's kind of pre-Hammurabi. It's always me and mine and what I think and where I can gather power and hold my power. That's the country we have now. And so I don't put my stock in it. I vote, right? And I keep my political mouth shut. I have opinions. But I don't put my faith in politics ever. You know, when I said I don't have any faith and I don't have any beliefs, I don't believe in anything. I mean, I came back not believing in anything in this universe. I don't believe in physics. I don't believe in anything. All of it. The whole thing is a construct. Everything is like, it's like living in the Matrix. And the movie's The Matrix, only God is this loving being, not an evil machine. But the whole thing, all 13 billion years of it from where I sit, it's all temporary. It's all passing through. None of it's permanent. I don't invest myself in that. I invest myself in what lasts eternally because I know that's where I'm from. And so I've been politically active in my life, but I don't put any stock in it. I think it's there to protect people, but all I want to do is talk about love. Because if I'm going to be talking about which political candidate to vote for, that just brings divisiveness. That just brings divisiveness. So, and I don't think that, I don't think I have all the answers. I just definitely don't. I don't. I watch what goes on in politics. And I pray. But I know that that's not enough either. So I vote. And I'm going to keep on voting. That's the best I can say. I don't trust him. And you know, I'm from Maine. I don't know if you follow what goes on in Maine. You probably don't. You live out in Utah. But one of our senators, she's probably not going to get reelected. And I like her. I know her. Can't really say I've ever voted for her. Yes, that's true. No, I did vote for her. I definitely did. But I'm not voting for her this time. Have you ever been back to the monastery? Oh, yeah. I sure did. I became a devotee. And when my spiritual director, his name was Theophane Boyd, he was the novitiate master at St. Joseph's Abbey, where Thomas Keating was the abbot. When they retired to, Natalie, you need to go to the top of your screen and not share your screen. We're seeing your screen. So there you go. Thanks. So yeah, I went back to the monastery regularly, and when they retired to Snowmass in Colorado, I would go there. I had church members who would pay my way, which was really great because I was a poor pastor. But yeah, I continued to go and hang out with them as much as I could. But I had kids, you know. Thank you for sharing your love with us tonight. You're welcome, Denise. Was the life review pretty painful? Yeah, it was awful. And it felt like it was eternal. It was in timelessness. It was in, I just playing with a stone here. I dropped it, made some noise. Yeah, it felt eternal to me. And it was the most painful thing I've ever been through. And I rather expect to go through another one. And I'm happy to, actually. I'm happy to go through another one because I get to pop out into heaven again. And that's fabulous, with a capital F. How long did your life review take? I don't know. Everything was in timelessness, Denise. It was all, I don't know. I was dead. All I can say is that I knew that I was dead long enough that my partner, Tim, I was dead to him. And he was scared out of his mind. Because he was going to die. And so that's all I know. And how long it took for to go through that until I can say this. I went through every single bit of pain that I gave to everyone in my entire life. Completely.
Mike, for you, you relived all.
Somebody's got their mic on. We usually wrap it up sometime around 8:30 or 11:30 my time. Great stuff. I agree with all my ideas. Yeah. So that was, I was reading a private note from the actual host, and I know I don't even know what time it is. What time is it? It's like 11:22, 11:23. It's getting late. I'm happy to wrap it up if you want. Or I should leave more time for questions.
Yeah, you probably on the East Coast.
A few more questions, and then whatever time you guys wrap it up, you should wrap it up, Craig.
What if you want to repost this?
Are you charging yours?
Yeah, somebody's got their mic on. I've got...
Mine just signaled me that I'm down Karen? To 15%, and if I don't charge right now, they're going to...
Hey, Karen. Karen, your mic's on. It's okay.
I was listening to that IAMS podcast, and that guy went on for such a long time.
You have the ability to for such
a mic. I just muted her, and I went on for a long time. That's okay. I do. Preachers have that habit, so sorry. Any other comments or questions? Nope. You can unmute for a second if you want to say something. Okie dokie. Thanks for coming,
You've
everybody.
Been great. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. I'm not sure who said that even, but thank you. Okie dokie. So I guess I'm the one who has to close the meeting because I'm the host, right, Craig? Yep, that is totally true. Can I unmute everybody? Do I have the power to unmute everybody? Unmute all. You're all unmuted. We're going to meet back to the one.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Oh, so much. Kristen. I recognize you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Zoom rock.
Zoom meetings. They're fun.
Mysticism all right. Rocks.
All right, I'm gonna close the meeting, I guess. Yes, Craig. Give me a,
thank you,
all right. Good night, everybody. God is love. Peace.
Bye.
Peace. Bye.
Oh.
Meeting for.